15 will come to order. Colleagues, I want to go down the list and discuss this fairly long agenda that we have for today. Just want to let you know that we're going to work Senate Bill 63 later, and I'm not sure when it's going to be rescheduled, but it's the technical bill having to do with the reconnection to the Federal Internal Revenue Code. It's possible that we may want some amendments to that, and because it's a Senate bill, we have time. We're taking off House Bill 2171. If that comes up, it will be rescheduled. We're going to move till tomorrow House Bill 2449, the work session on that, and the work session on House Bill 2075, and the work session on House Bill 2818. Those are over till tomorrow. So anybody who's here on those bills, you're excused. We're not all running out at once. Okay. We're going to try to open a number of other bills. I will tell you that House Bill 2099, we want to have a conversation about, so we'll open the work session, but it's not ready to work yet. And also, that same thing applies to House Bill 2077. So I think I've mentioned all of them that we need to manage. My plan at this point is to hold the public hearing on House Bill 2106 at the end of the meeting rather than at the beginning, so we can work through these work sessions. And with that, we have one member who has to leave for another meeting, and I think the bill that you're directly interested in is 2494, isn't it? Or am I?
It is.
So why don't we open the work session on House Bill?
Great bill.
2494.
Great bill.
And let's discuss that bill, Paul, and then we may not lose the member who's particularly interested in it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2494. You had a hearing on it back in April, and you have now an amendment, a -1 amendment. That's requested by Representative Davis. And what that amendment does is clarify a few things in the original bill, which was directing the Legislative Revenue Office to prepare economic impact statements at the request of the legislator. What this bill does is it specifies that for the request to be formal, it would be two members, one from each of the major parties, and they can be and should be members of the Revenue Committee, either the House or Senate Revenue Committee. So any combination of those, and would be able to make a request to the Legislative Revenue Officer for employment impacts. It also gives the Legislative Revenue Officer an opportunity to determine whether it's feasible or not within resources and timing, and whether it's something that the modeling capabilities of the office can handle. So there's a feasibility issue. And then it does state that the economic impacts, which would be income, employment, sectoral kind of analysis, would at a minimum require direct and indirect effects.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what's your pleasure? Discussion of the bill, or
just briefly, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please. Representative Davis.
I want to thank staff very much for meeting with me and discussing the existing resources and what additional resources might be available. I think this could be a good first step towards having some additional research capabilities for the effect of legislation that we passed, but this is a pretty modest first step. The reason for having the requests through the come through members of the House or Senate Revenue Committees are simply because the Legislative Revenue Officer, by statute and rule, reports through the chair of either of these committees. So it sort of maintains the structure that we have existing for LRO staff. Also, it's intended to sort of reduce volume. We've talked about peak load issues that could come up with members deluging LRO with requests for economic impact statements. And that's also the intent of the feasibility limitation. If it's not feasible either within existing resources or the amount of time necessary, LRO wouldn't be required to issue the statement.
Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, will point out there is a fiscal impact statement in the OLIS for the dash one. And this is based on discussions we've had. We're estimating that the fiscal impact on the office would be about $40,000 for the biennium. This would require some additional training for our staff. We have models now that are focused really on the revenue impact side or the tax side. This would be more impact-oriented models. The main cost would be we would have to update the databases for both of our RIMI model or implant model on a regular annual basis. And that costs us about $10,000 for one, $5,000 for the other. So that's about 30 of that $40,000. The rest would be some additional training for our economists to make sure that they were ready to do this kind of analysis when it was requested. So that's, we don't have a request to go to Ways and Means, so we do have the fiscal impact, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, does it need to go to Ways and Means?
In my opinion, Mr. Chair, no. I think we'll make sure we work with LFO to recognize that this bill gets through, that it'll be part of our budget. We'll work with them.
Ah, okay.
We're close friends.
Those are wonderful words.
Well, a little inside baseball, but yes. Representative Davis, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment.
Sorry.
Okay. Sorry. I can talk about it as part of the amendment. Yeah. Or
okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2494.
Representative Davis moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2494. Now, Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I think we share a lot of interests in, I think there's a lot of, we're all kind of trying to get to a similar place in terms of clarity and transparency and more information for all of us to have on this. And another of the House Bill 3542 that we're also planning to work, it's also on the list to work.
Plug.
To work today. I think these both get to similar places in slightly different directions. So I just want to say that I do have one question. Was there any discussion about as far as the what you said, and I can't remember the load variance.
Peak load.
Peak load, there we go. Was there any discussion about like limiting it to ones that have had hearing? I mean, the concern about any bill that is introduced, I mean, talk about load. You know, there's thousands of bills that we get introduced that don't all necessarily get hearing. Was there any discussion of that? Was there kind of an assumption that it would be a bill that was up for here? I guess I just wanted to ask you. I could have asked you offline, but it didn't occur to me.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We, or Mr. Chair, if I could. There had been some discussion of that, and I admit that we just sort of sidelined that and didn't come back to it, but I appreciate that as a concern. It's different than a revenue impact statement or a legislative fiscal statement in that this wouldn't be required of any measure to move through the process, so it'd be discretionary.
True.
And the requests, we've got the limitation that has to come through our committees, limitation on two members, but so it was discussed, but we just didn't incorporate it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, and one of the things that I've thought of after discussing with Representative Davis is a good timing of this. You know, when you come in mid-January and we get like 800 bills and then we have a couple of weeks, that seems to me that would be a good time to designate something that you'd want this additional analysis. And we typically do have some time then where we could do that and have it ready, you know, the first few weeks of the session.
And of course, this might very well apply to bills that don't end up in the Revenue Committee, mightn't it?
Yes.
And so that would be an extra limitation. Mm-hmm. There are lots of bills in other committees that purport to have positive revenue impact, and finding out whether they really do or not might be beneficial. Representative Baker Peterson.
I would just say, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think that we might find ourselves very popular during those 2 weeks as people want to these bills.
I didn't thought of that. Yes. Okay. It adds complexity. All right. Anything else on the amendment? The motion is on the adoption of the dash one. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Davis, do you want to do the honors?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2494 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Davis moves House Bill 2494 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion carries. Representative Davis, would you like to carry this bill,
or
shall I find somebody
impose
else?
It on Clem because he's the co-sponsor, but I'll take it.
Okay. I mean, we could ask Representative Clem.
No, that'd
prefer.
Be me.
Okay. All right. So this one is out. Okay. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2494. And Representative Leininger, did you also have to leave early today? Mm-hmm. No? So let's go back to the beginning and open the work session on House Bill 2099. Now, colleagues, this is not one that we're ready to move today. It still needs some additional work, but Paul wanted to describe the Dash 4 amendment, where we are. There's some additional changes that need to be made in this amendment. I'll simply note before he starts that this is a complex issue. We want to get it right. We think we're close to doing that. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2099-4 is the amendment that is the one we've been working on. And it's not ready for prime time, as the Chair said. We've noticed several things, and we'll be working with the Department of Revenue on a couple of those. One of the things we did do, and I think this may have added to complexity, some of the provisions of this apply to the 2015 tax year and some to the 2016, and that might be something we would modify to simplify it. But there is, if you look under on the first page, the list of jurisdictions is the current list, the one with one exception. And that is Panama, which is added to the list, which was originally on the list and is on the Montana list. So we added that to the group went in with the original 2013 legislation. So that would apply to the 15 tax year. The policy change that is made here is on the bottom of page one. It's section 2, sub 2, and it has to do with income that's reported in a listed jurisdiction, but does not have, it does not originate from the U.S. So, for example, if income was paid out through a dividend, for example, to a country, to Germany, for example, from the U.S. to Germany, and then came back to the listed jurisdiction, then that would still count because it had originated in the U.S. But if it was income that originated in Germany, and then the income was transferred to one of the listed jurisdictions and never was not original from the U.S., that can be subtracted out when you're adding in the income from the jurisdiction. So for the individual corporations that have a part of their unitary filing, one of the corporations is within this listed jurisdiction, then they would still have to list all the income from that listed jurisdiction, but they could subtract out the income that didn't originate from the U.S. So that would, in effect, pull them out of the calculation, so it wouldn't be added back and apportioned back to ORA again. So that's one policy change. There was a technical issue around not including corporations that file separately. It's just those that are the unitary corporations that are filing the consolidated returns. So you'll notice some language referring to consolidated or separate returns. So that's just was an oversight in the original legislation. Section 3 does add the jurisdictions that were recommended in the original January Department of Revenue report. And you can see those in black on page 2. It's Guatemala, it's Hong Kong, Kingdom of the Netherlands, Switzerland, and then Trinidad and Tobago. So those are all added as part of this amendment. And that's those are the major substantive changes. If you look on page 5, section 5, and again, we need to modify this a little bit, but the intent here is to use the criteria that Department of Revenue described in their a report that you directed them to do that really comes back from the Mullis State Tax Commission on what constitutes a tax haven for jurisdiction purposes in terms of this designation. And so we wanted to codify that so that it wasn't just a list of jurisdictions. There was some basis in statute for what determined those that list. And so then, so the recommendation we had there is that makes it clear to anyone looking at the statute where this list came from. That's already in statute. So that was the purpose of that. So that's the dash four. I did go through and...
why don't you explain that, the section seven as well? Just because this is a little bit difficult to read if you don't understand section seven.
Yes. Section seven has to do with the different starting dates. The change in the list... from the original list, based on the recommendations from the department, becomes effective in January 1 of 16. The changes, for example, for the subtraction, for adding Panama to the original list, and that dates back to January 1 of 15. So as I said at the beginning, we may have added more complexity there than we intended to. We'll make a recommendation on that if we can match those up and have that make easier administration.
When I read this amendment yesterday, it didn't make any sense to me until I got to Section 7. Then all of a sudden I understood what you were doing.
Yes. Yeah. And really, Mr. Chair, it just was kind of a question of how we were thinking of the issues. We're thinking of them sequentially, saying these are the things on the ground now that should be changed. And then the second step was, okay, additions to the list based on the recommendations.
Okay. Now, you're going to have another amendment with some other... Oh, you want to talk about the revenue impact. Please go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did prepare a dash four revenue impact that should be in OLIS there.
Yep.
The basis for these calculations, and I think we've made this clear to the committee, we have no hard data about revenue coming in from these jurisdictions. The 2013 legislation first applied to the 2014 tax year, so we haven't gotten any hard data at all. So as we go back and look at the possible impact of additions to the list, we have to start from that first estimate. And that first estimate was driven by the numbers, the only real numbers we had, and that was from Montana. By the way, I did put the Montana 2012 report up, and I think we had that. We've looked at that in the past, but that's the most detailed report we have from them on their estimates. It describes what they are, where the countries came from, along with a series of other issues. So those who want to look at the Montana experience more closely, that's out there. But basically, we started from that Montana base. We have an estimate of what U.S. affiliates report in net income by country from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. We used that, and I was able to match that up for the new countries, which, of course, we don't have any Montana data for because they're not on the Montana list, to the existing list from Montana and adjust that base with those relative proportions. You may also recall that we looked at the interaction of additional net income with Oregon's corporate apportionment formula. And we accounted for that as best we could by taking the GDP of the countries that were considered it to be part of the list. So the bigger your GDP, presumably, the more sales you're going to have in that jurisdiction, and the more that would dilute or water down the Oregon apportionment factor, so you'd have a smaller proportion of that income that would show up on the Oregon return. If you look at the numbers, you can see that for 15-17, the new countries are added in with a 16 corporate tax year, so basically you have 1 year. And you can see that we're estimating about $14 million for that year, about $27 million for 17-19 biennium, and a similar amount for 2021. The numbers don't grow much in these estimates because they're tied to our base corporate income tax projections, which are pretty flat. And that's why you see that very little growth once you get out to the full 2 years.
Great. And are you planning to prepare a breakdown country by country for that list or not?
Mr. Chair, I can do that. I don't have that ready today, but I can do that based on that BEA income we have. We have some limitations with that for the individual countries because a number of the smaller ones we don't have individual numbers for them because they're subject to disclosure law. So they just kind of have a assemble there. Or they may have their sales reported, but not their net income, or vice versa.
Okay, all right. But those tend to be smaller numbers anyway, I assume.
My assumption is they're very small, yes, if they show up that way. And so they have no impact, really, on the revenue.
Right. Yes. So we have another amendment coming?
Yes.
All right. So if you have questions about the content of the Dash 4, recognizing that there will be another amendment that will clarify some of these issues, it would be fine to ask them now. Otherwise, we can wait until we get the final version. Representative Whitsitt?
I was wondering how we had the Isle of Man and Jersey and not Great Britain.
Or United Kingdom?
Ireland, yeah, United Kingdom. How that came to be.
Representative Whitsitt, for the original list, we used the list that was from Montana. So those were not on Montana. And then when we asked the Department of Revenue to review that list and then make recommendations, they did not include those other countries. I know, and they did consider Ireland in particular, made the decision from based on their recommendations that it didn't fit the criteria that's laid out in the report.
All right. Yes, Representative Bence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Paul, I think you said at the beginning of your discussion of the bill that we want to figure out where the income originated. How do you do that?
Representative Bence, Mr. Chair, the income that we have from the BEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis, U.S. affiliate income, originates from the U.S. So that our database is what we're trying to measure. Our concern is that when we have a subsidiary report its net income back, it may be more than just those U.S. affiliates that's in that amount. And the way the law reads now, you just have to report that entire amount that's reported in that jurisdiction. So this makes an exception for when you have a transaction that involves income that doesn't originate from the U.S., then you can subtract it from that total. So you still have to report the total from the listed jurisdiction, but then you can subtract out that amount that doesn't originate from the U.S.
Follow up.
Yeah.
And how do we know they're telling the truth?
Uh-huh.
That's
the typical compliance problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the ways of thinking about this bill is as an enhanced reporting mechanism. We're talking about taxes that it's our view are already due. That's why it's a compliance bill rather than a bill for raising revenue. So what this really does is tell the company, please file a tax return that contains the details about these kinds of transactions, and then tell us what you think you owe based on the considerations that are in the bottom of page one, top of page two. What is that? Section one, sub two. Mm-hmm. And so you can think about this as a way of getting the corporations to tell on themselves, and then to determine and pay the tax. It also improves the likelihood that the department will make good choices about which corporations to audit, because it will already have a significant amount of data in the tax return. Representative Davis? I'm sorry, Representative Bence? Yeah. I'm doing this. I'm confusing the two of you.
Yeah, yeah. So the question, I guess,
I'm
is,
honored.
Mr. Chair.
He's not.
Thank you. So the question, I suppose, is how much more staff will it take to try to utilize the data that we hope to have come through the door as a result of this?
In the department, I assume.
Exactly.
Yeah, in the department, yeah.
Well, I would suggest, Mr. Chair, we ask the department.
If they're here and if they're ready to answer the question. It's a nice problem to take to the Ways and Means Committee, isn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Joe DiNicola, Oregon Department of Revenue. And again, the question would be how much additional staff time, and I'm not sure I understood the parameters for which piece or which part of this legislation.
Yeah.
So the reason for the bill, one of the reasons for the bill is to generate more information from different corporations doing business overseas. And so let's assume that that information actually appears. Who in your department is available to go through it with the detail necessary to make any headway in these types of analysis? Because it's been suggested that what we might see are incomplete versions of money moving from different countries having little to do with Oregon, and you'd have to trace this money as best you could. I'm not sure how you're even going to get started. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't do it. I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to do it if this legislation were to pass, or if we're capable of doing it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, yes, it's a good question, and as in any legislation, there's always that trade-off between complexity and ease of administration. And as the bill, as the law currently requires, it's very simple to administer. We have a listed jurisdiction. We have a subsidiary in that listed jurisdiction. All of its income is included in the apportionable base. It's very easy to administer, relatively easy to administer, and relatively easy for compliance purposes. The new amendment, or the proposed amendment, -4 amendment, proposes some additional complexity in that we would still add back 100% of the income from the listed jurisdiction. And then, as Paul explained, we would be providing that the taxpayer can eliminate that income that was not attributable directly to transactions with subsidiaries or affiliates in the United States. Certainly the taxpayer has that information available to them, and your question is, do we have audit resources to follow up on that to ensure that it's accurate? Yes, we do, and that is the Department of Revenue does. We have corporate tax auditors who are trained in this work, and it's a question of allocating resources then to determine what the most effective use of those resources might be. Again, the information is readily available to the corporate taxpayer and the filer, and any transactions would be reported or obtained through a review of the federal tax return, which is part of our audit function, to determine whether there were transactions with these affiliates overseas that are then reflected in the listed jurisdiction base income. So the information is obtainable, but it does require, would require some audit work to verify.
Yeah.
Right, and so the question is, how much more help will you need in order to do what this anticipates?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I would not anticipate that the department would request additional resources for this work. It would be a question of allocating existing resources to determine the most effective use, and in determining which corporations and which entities where we focus our audit resources.
Thank you.
You do triage routinely, don't you? You figure out where the places are that we're most likely to hit pay dirt, and that's what you go after. And other things that you don't have enough money for, you don't do that year.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Okay. All right. And other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anything else for today on 2099? If not, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2099. Colleagues, my plan is to reopen this tomorrow. We will post it for tomorrow and reopen if we have any new news on it. And with that, let's continue down our list and open for work House Bill 2077. Again, I don't think this one's ready, but we wanted to have a conversation about where we are. Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2077 is a corporate disclosure bill. Pertains to the Department of Revenue publicly releasing certain information from corporate tax returns. There is a -2 in OLIS that replaces the drafted bill. And so I was just going to walk through that a little bit.
Please, yeah.
assuming I can find it. Pull it up.
There it is.
Okay, there it is. So the main point of it at a high level is there are about 30,000 C corporation tax returns. And so the notion of disclosing some amount of information there can be pretty vast. And what we have in the dash two is basically a top 100 list, or more specifically, four top 100 lists. And at the bottom of page one, we can see what those top 100 lists are. The first one would be Oregon sales. The second list, so it would be the top, the C corporations that have the most Oregon sales, the top 100 Oregon sales. And then a second list would be the top 100 C corporations for taxable income. And then the third one would be the top 100 C corporations for total amount of corporate tax credits claimed. And then moving on to page two, the top 100 corporations with respect to tax liability, Oregon tax liability. And then within each of these lists, there would be five pieces of information disclosed. And that's on page two, lines 7 through 12, or 7 through 11. The first one is the name of the corporate, name of the taxpayer, then the taxpayer's Oregon sales, their taxable income, their total credits, and then their Oregon tax liability. And so this was really a first step at getting an amendment drafted and shared for committee discussion and review. And I already have a number of potential changes to the bill, and I can walk through those, or?
I think it would be useful.
Okay.
I mean, it isn't the plan to move this one.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Well, the idea was the bill as drafted obviously drew a lot of attention, and so in terms of the amendment here, we started with something a little more containable with respect to the concept, and then we would build from there. So a couple of the
And you might indicate how this relates to our agreement with the Internal Revenue Service around confidentiality as well.
Yes.
Please, go ahead.
And that, Mr. Chair, that is one of the big issues in terms of what information can be shared that doesn't violate agreements with the IRS. Within the federal statutes, the IRS requires non-disclosure of their data. So if we were to disclose their data, they would basically stop providing information to the Department of Revenue, which would affect audit information or the ability of our Department of Revenue to audit returns and correctly assess and determine Oregon tax. So that is an overarching theme here. And I'll touch on that in a couple of different ways here as we move through this. So starting on page one, bouncing back to page one, lines 7 through 10, there's a statement here: the information submitted shall be as provided by taxpayers on returns prior to any processing, amending, or auditing of returns, but may be corrected for mathematical errors. The idea here is to get at the information that can be easily be provided by the Department of Revenue without a lot of work on the department's part. And so the details of how we actually describe that information is a subject of ongoing discussions. And so we have the conceptual level of what is easy to provide. Because on the one hand, it's the information that is simply provided by the taxpayer. So that if the taxpayer were to look at their information, it would be, yes, that's what we told the Department of Revenue. One of the complexities there is the information as provided by the taxpayer may not be sufficient for DOR to even begin processing the return. There may be omissions of data. There may be arithmetic errors that the department has to correct for it to even go through their process. So how we describe that is part of the discussion here, because that's not really a process return. It's kind of a first-stage processing issue. And don't want to go down the path of amended returns or audited returns. It's really a first snapshot, because this would be a regular report produced, at least conceived here, once a year. It would be provided, and it would be a snapshot of these top 100 lists. And to avoid the situation of the Department of Revenue of having to go back and modify this list. Again, the intent of the information is really just a snapshot of those top 100 lists and not a refinement of those data elements. And number of reasons for that. Part of it would be revealing the Department of Revenue's processes for selecting returns and how they audit returns and what they're looking for.
I mean, to avoid doing that.
To avoid doing that, yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. So that language is being scrutinized right now. And then in subsection 2, lines 14 through 19, the idea here is, so once a year the department produces these lists, and for which tax year is relevant. And so the language there is a little awkward in terms of preceding the calendar year, immediately preceding the calendar year in which the report is due. That's not a typo. In any one year, there is, because of the corporations have different fiscal years, and then they can file for an extension. A lot of the large corporations routinely file for extension. So it can be a couple of years for a given tax year to have complete information. Part of the frame of reference here is the Department of Revenue's research section publishes a report that I think the committee is familiar with on their tax returns, and that has a two-year lag. And so within the notion of having a top 100 list, you want to have a complete set of returns for a given tax year. So the issue here is, how do we get at timely disclosed information that is timely disclosed as well as combined with the top 100 list? So there's a time period there that we're trying to get at. Another piece of this, touching back on the IRS data, is to go through steps that make sure that we do not disclose any federal information. And there are a couple of ways we're thinking about getting at that. There are, as the committee is aware, there's Chapter 317 and Chapter 318. Chapter 317 is really the bulk of the tax. That's for corporations doing business in the state. And that's the excise tax. And then Chapter 318 is for corporations who aren't doing business in the state but just pay tax. They have Oregon-sourced income. And one risk on this list is if there is an Oregon-only corporation. So the idea is to limit the list to corporations that apportion their income. Because if you think about a corporation that only operates within Oregon, any of the information on their return could be exactly the same information that shows up on their federal return, because for many of these pieces, that will be the same information. For example, if all of their sales are in Oregon, then the total of their national sales would be all that is in Oregon and also be reflected on the federal return. So one possible way that is being discussed to get around that is to limit it to corporations that are apportioned, and that can be described a couple of different ways. The apportionment percentage, as long as it's less than 100%, then they're doing business in other states. And the theme of all of those parameters are to avoid the accidental disclosure of federal return information. A couple of, on line 20, the concept of sales in Oregon is referenced twice in the bill. And so on line 20, it says sales in Oregon. The idea here is to change that to taxpayers' Oregon sales, which would line up with the language that is on page 2, line 8. So that's a minor clarification. And then a couple of other wording changes on page 2, line 9. It says the taxpayer's taxable income. We want to add the word Oregon there to make sure it's clear that it's Oregon taxable income. Clearly, that's the intent from the bill, but we want to make sure it's crystal clear. And then in lines 12 through 14, we're getting back to the IRS situation, and the language in there on line 13, it refers to in violation of section 6103 of the IRC. There is a point there about changing that wording to described in section 6103, where we're just referencing the data, not worried about the implications of using the term violation leading to some criminal activity or something like this, and we don't want to go there, but it's really just that information. And then the last technical note I have here is the way it's drafted, the first time this list would be produced would be on December 1st of 2015. That is when the Department of Revenue will be rolling out the personal income tax program for the new core system. and the committee has tried to stay away from overlapping that kind of burden on the department. So the idea would be to move that back to 2016, and that's purely for administrative ease for the department.
But it would be available, the data would then be available for the 17 long session.
Yes. And the way, another piece, the way, the issue of disclosing the information is pretty broad. It could be anything from a list that DOR puts on their website or on an interactive website. And again, from a first step containment process here, the lists here, as envisioned in this version, would be provided to the Legislative Revenue Office, and then we would make it public. The way we were thinking about this is our annual basic facts publication, which we provide at the beginning of every legislative session. We could just insert it in there, and then it's made public that way. Just again, trying to get at a first step on how this information might be shared and minimizing costs to the relevant state agencies.
Right. Okay. Again, this obviously this is not ready to work today, but if there are questions for Chris. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, what is it? I was trying to figure out what one could do with the material that would be disclosed after it is disclosed. We see the sales. We see the income generated by the sales. We see the tax credits taken, and we see the tax paid. So what is it that folks that are looking at this can do with that information?
Well, one way that we've thought about it, and this ties into another bill about the models that the department that Ella wrote that we use to describe implications of tax policies, and we have to be very careful when we talk about that. And we can talk about impacts and broad policies at a high level. Inevitably, examples tend to be very helpful. People like to see examples, and with particularly on the corporate side, we kind of have to mesh things together to come up and make sure that we're using an example that doesn't disclose any information. And we need to be very careful about that. One possible use of this would be the ability to talk about specific examples of the corporations that are on this list. Since those key pieces of information would be available, then that might facilitate that conversation.
Hold on.
Yeah, please.
The federal government is concerned, apparently, about this information not getting out, so they prevent it from happening. Did your research reflect why they're concerned, or is it just the way it is?
Rep. Vance, I guess I would need to say I would need to do more research on exactly the motivations behind that, or all the reasons why, other than it's always been that way, which isn't a very satisfying answer.
It's been around for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah. Follow up. Yeah. Yeah, so when I see this, obviously I instantly want to know why if the tax liability turns out to be modest, you'd want to know why. Could you in any way determine that from the information that you would now have available as a result of this bill?
I think one of the possibilities for this, with the information being released, it obviously will draw a lot of attention, and a lot of people will be looking at it, and it'll be kind of a learning process, and other people will think of things and potential ways to use the data that perhaps we haven't thought of, and it will be probably just another step in the process, a first step in this process, not necessarily the final stage of how the information would be used. So it's kind of an open end, probably lead to more questions and other research ideas.
Thank you.
Yeah, journalists are looking forward to a bill like this, I think, because they'll go ask the company how come.
Mr. Chair, if I may, we may want to broaden this to include other people we're curious about or things. So why we're picking just on corporations is unclear. But I'm not sure that's within the scope of this discussion at this moment.
Right, thank you. And that is partly related to the Internal Revenue Agreement that we have, isn't it? Or isn't it?
I'm sorry, which?
The limitation to corporate tax returns.
Well, the IRS, the limitation there is very broad for any federal data. I think the first step along this path of a broader understanding of tax policy, this is kind of a first step in that path.
Representative Davis.
And thank you, Chair, and thanks very much for your work on this. I'm just wondering, under when there's references to Oregon tax liability in this bill, is that also, would you interpret this report as also including things like the property tax paid, the employment taxes withheld, the personal income tax paid or withheld on behalf of employees of the company, gas taxes paid, fees paid, or any other lists of fees and taxes that are due in Oregon?
The intent here is just the excise tax or the income tax.
Okay. Just
and
sure.
Actually, it would be the excise tax. I mean, we commonly refer to it as the income tax. Technically speaking, all of the corporate tax revenue that is discussed is the corporate excise tax, because we actually have a corporate excise tax and a corporate income tax. The corporate income tax only applies to or applies to corporations who aren't doing business in Oregon. They have an Oregon source. So that's not really the focus of this, and that's Chapter 318. It's really Chapter 317, which are the corporations doing business in Oregon.
But so, excuse me, follow up. I'm just wondering, I mean, the bill on page 2, line 2, does say Oregon tax liability. I don't see that limited to excise tax.
I've made a note to add that to the list of amendments, the concept there.
I would note the related clauses relating to corporate tax disclosure. I think your proposed expansion would be quite useful, but it wouldn't fit in this bill, the way the bill's relating clause, I think.
Well, Mr. Chair, these are corporations and they pay tax. This doesn't say relating to corporate excise tax.
No, it doesn't say that. You're right. Thank you. It's an interesting suggestion. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what will be the process for determining who these 100 largest taxpayers are or will be? Would you not already know that based on current data?
It could vary from year to year. So in any given year, the department, so there are a lot of technical issues. For a given tax year, say tax year 2015, once all of those tax returns have been filed, then for any one of these lists, the Department of Revenue would be able to look at all of these C corporations that apportion their income and look at how much each corporation has in Oregon sales, basically sort them from largest to smallest, and then the top 100 would be that first list. And then just those four or five pieces of information would be released for those corporations. And then there would be four such lists. So it could be the same corporations on all four lists, and there could be some variation across the lists.
Representative Smith.
I'll give him some more time to think. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, thank you for your work on this. I know that there's been some conversation about 100 as a kind of a, you know, as a the validity of that as a number. Do you have any thoughts on kind of the difference between setting it at a number versus setting it at, say, the top quintile or something like that?
That would be a pure policy choice. The concept there is controlling the amount of information that's out there, because 30,000 of these, to go on a report, that's an awfully long, complicated report. And a lot of corporations do not have a big footprint, if you will. So you have a lot of small C corporations that don't have a lot of sales, don't have a lot of taxable income, don't claim a lot of credits. They're the $150 minimum taxpayers.
Yeah, it would be the top 6,000, wouldn't it?
Something like that.
If it's a top quintile. Mm-hmm. And then you get into some fairly small businesses.
Yeah. And the top 100 or so is about half of the tax. So, and we often describe, when we're talking about the corporate income tax, and that's part of the reason it's so volatile, is that you have a handful, it might be a large, depending on the connotation, handful, of corporations that really are the focus of that tax. And so the 100, not a magical number, but
may I brief follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I feel like I've asked this before, but I just can't remember the answer. And there's not a way to do it by employer, right? Because that's not something that you could get from the DOR records, right?
By employer?
Employee. Like companies by number of employees.
That's correct. The number of employees is not a relevant piece of information for calculating tax. That's how I try to describe it. So on the corporation, on the return itself, there's nowhere where they tell the department how many employees they have.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And then I saw another hand. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just reflecting on the nature of this bill and thinking what its purpose is. And Chris, you'll have to tell me if you think the purpose that I'm guessing at is the one. It appears that if this played out the way it's designed, this information would be available not only to revenue, but to the public at large. Am I assuming that correctly, or not?
Yes, it would be the public at large, and the way it's roughly envisioned here would be through the basic facts publication. Again, removing it one step removed from the Department of Revenue, they would produce the list, then they would send it to us, and then we would make it public. There are two dates in here, December 1st of every year for the department to produce the list, and then the following February 1st for the Legislative Revenue Office to make it public.
And the follow-up.
Yeah, please.
And then the purpose of this making it, is it that we just heard that we had staff sufficient to do the analysis of offshore work, and we don't need any more people for that purpose. So this isn't really being done so that we can harness the computer abilities and the investigation abilities of the mass of public folk, or is it? If it is, then perhaps this technique can be broadened to a greater group than just corporations. Not that I'm suggesting it. It just seems odd that if we have adequate staff to do the job, why are we now making this public? Is it to embarrass people or entities? Is it to throw open the door so more people can be looking at other people's business? What is it exactly? What value are we as a state going to, what's going to accrue to us as a result of this?
Of course, that's a policy discussion rather than one for Chris, I think. Unless you think you can answer it.
can I help him out a bit?
Please, sure. You want to answer your own question?
Well, actually, I'm just going to give him a little direction, if he chooses to take it. It seems to me that that the question really is, does the Department of Revenue need this tool to do its job better? Mm-hmm. Ignoring the greater public, does the Department of Revenue need this tool? And we should maybe have them come up and tell us.
Well, I think it's irrelevant. The reality is that the point of transparency laws is to allow the public to know and the legislature to know how the tax laws are operating and whether they're fair and appropriate or whether they need reformation. Lots and lots of the transparency rules that we've adopted over the last several biennia have been designed for that purpose, and this would be, assuming that it works at all, this would be one more in that list. It allows the public to participate in the conversation about tax policy.
You're right, it is a policy question when answered that way.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's very much a policy question. I'd be astounded if it would aid the department in doing their work, because they already have the information. Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
But if we're looking for transparency, and I suppose this goes to the policy question, wouldn't it behoove us to see everybody's then, unions and NGOs and everybody's mm-hmm. tax records, so we could see exactly what's going on and who's paying and who isn't paying and what they're paying? Mm-hmm.
The reality, of course, is that this is a stepwise process, and we don't know how far it's going to go. I would be very much amazed if it got that far, for a whole lot of reasons that you can imagine yourself. Yeah. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just feel obliged. As somebody who has worked for a union in the past, there are a lot of disclosure laws already federally, and I can't speak for the state, but there are a lot of federal disclosure laws about unions' financial situations. In the same way, for public corporations, there are, at the federal level, a lot of disclosure laws. So what we're trying to get to is, what can we get to on the disclosure front at a state level that I'll just stop.
Yeah, most of these top 100 businesses in all of these categories are going to be either publicly traded national and international corporations, or very, very large privately owned corporations, aren't they?
That's correct. And the names may not even be household names. They could be holding company XYZ.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's where the journalists trying to figure out who's what comes in, and we get some help in our evaluation of tax policy. I mean, this is one of those situations where you have to decide what you value more, the privacy of the company or the ability to use the information to make tax policy. And that, of course, really very much is a policy question. Anything else for today? We'll get another look at the amendment as it comes in. If not, we'll close the work session, and this is 2077.
Yes.
And House Bill 2077. And colleagues, we're going to post this one for tomorrow again, although I'm not sure that we'll actually have any additional information, in which case it will probably move over again. And with that, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2316. And unlike the others, I think 2316 might be ready. We'll hear from Mazza.
We'll leave Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and the rest of what's left of the audience. House Bill 2316 to refresh your memory about it, is the bill about the court fees or the fees for county courts, for justice courts. This is the bill that increases those fees. And as you were discussing the last time when this was brought to the committee, it had a number of different types of fees. And as we looked at it, this is not necessarily a cost recovery, because most of the fees still will not be raised sufficiently to actually cover all costs. However, they are testimony by the counties and the county courts, just enough to defray some of the costs. And the last time when you were discussing this, I think Vice Chair Vega Peterson had a couple issues or questions about the fee for the trial, whether it is a jury trial or not, and both of them having a $100 fee. And at that time, we left with a couple of those questions to be answered. One of them that you, Mr. Chair, wanted to check with Representative Barker about if this was any issues to him, or if the committee, the Judiciary Committee, have discussed or had any problem with that. And I checked with him, and he does not see any issues with that they did not discuss it at all as a problem with the fee. Now, the answer to many of these questions is having two different fees is primarily is because of the timing. It's a timing issue, and the timing issue says that the trial fee is made, or the fee for trial by jury is made when the trial is demanded, while the one without jury is at the time when it is set. So the fee is paid at different times. And that's why there was two fee separation. However, the members of the different sides who had to deal with this issue kind of agreed into setting a different fee for these two, and that's in the A7 amendment, as you have it, and on all us. And the counties are also here to basically concur that everybody agreed to this new change in the fee amounts. And accordingly, also, you have in all this a revenue impact statement, and this is for the county courts. So the amounts that you have are for all-inclusive courts in general. And then also you have a fiscal statement of a minimal fiscal impact. That's what I have an update for you.
Great. So what's your pleasure, colleagues? This bill's already been heard by the Judiciary Committee. I think they liked it. I believe it passed unanimously, didn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Representative Bentz?
Mr. Chair, I move the A7 amendment to...
Representative Bentz moves the A7 amendment to House Bill 2316. Is there a discussion? Any objection? Oh, Representative Vega Peterson.
I just appreciate the follow-up that was done on the comments about looking at the two different types of trials and the appropriate fees, and so I appreciate the work on the -7 amendment.
Thank you. Yes. I'll ditto that, if I may. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the A7 amendment is adopted. Representative Bentz?
Chair, move House Bill 2316 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2316 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? All right, seeing none, it's so ordered. Who would like to carry this bill? Don't all take it? Well, now, I could ask Representative Barker to carry. It, after all, is in his area. Why don't we do that? Let's ask Representative Barker to carry the bill, and if he doesn't want to, we'll assign somebody then. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2316 and open a work session on House Bill 3542. And whose bill is that? Paul. And it may not be as early as you'd hoped for, but we're finally getting to it.
Hey, that's great. Yeah. That's great. There
we go. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3542, you heard on April 23rd. You do have a -1 amendment that you actually had at that time. So that makes a couple of modifications to the bill that was based on discussions. The bill essentially is a follow-up and put in the same section as House Bill 2002, which you approved in the 13 session. So basically what it does is requires that the chief sponsor or proponent of a bill expanding or creating a tax credit to submit a statement of purpose and directs the legislative revenue officer prepare a report consisting of tax credits that have a revenue impact of 10% or more greater than the original revenue impact estimate. Another change that's put in the amendment, the -1, is reference instead of to the immediately preceding tax year, it would be the most recent tax year in terms of data availability. So as you know, based on the corporate returns, oftentimes there's a couple of year lag when that data comes in, but that's built into the -1. There's no revenue impact on the bill, and we have given it a minimal fiscal impact.
How does it relate, if it does, to the bill that we passed today, which I think requires very similar information? Do you know? Perhaps Representative Leininger knows the answer to that.
Well, I'll take a stab at it, Chair Barnhart, and Mr. Warner, correct me if you think I've omitted something. I think what this does is import into discussions of a new or expanded tax credit conversation of two pieces of information that, by legislation adopted in 2013, must be included in discussions of extension of a tax credit. And those two pieces of information are the purpose of the tax credit and essentially what is it trying to accomplish and how will we know? What is the mechanism for measuring what is trying to be accomplished? Now, as it is in extension of tax credit situations, sometimes the Legislative Revenue Office must try to discern just from context what those two pieces of information are, because it's not always clear what the purpose was and how it was intended to be measured or success would be manifest. So this would just simply take the words right out of Mr. Warner's mouth, as I've done by jumping in, and it would require the chief sponsor of the bill, in this instance, Representative Smith Warner and me, to state what it is we're trying to do and how we'll know if it's succeeding, so that people know at the get-go, and the job of legislative revenue will be more streamlined and clear at the point of conversation about extension. And it also requires essentially just to flag if the uptake on a bill is a lot greater than was expected, for that to be flagged so people can know, hey, have we really come up with a great way of creating new jobs, and so more people are using this credit than we had expected, or on the other side, you know, have we overly sweetened the incentive and so more people are taking it up? It does not require conversation about sunset. It just flags the issue. And if I may continue, Representative Davis had posed a question when we had our initial hearing about whether or not it, you know, a bill that requires legislators to articulate a certain thing would be an impermissible tying of hands. And we got a legal opinion from Ledge Council saying that that was not a problem.
Great. Good to know. Representative Davis.
And if I can comment on that, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was the day after the discussion of this bill, I looked back at the bills I'm sponsoring, one of which happens to be the bill we passed on the floor today requiring all measures to have a statement of purpose from the legislator. So having been a sponsor of a bill very similar to this one, of course it is constitutional.
That's right. Lucky you.
So I put some egg on my own face in that discussion. Thank you.
All right, Representative Reed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the operation of the bill, which had not occurred to me until just recently. There may be a very simple answer that's just not occurring to me. Going back in time to a particular tax credit that need not be named, that had a pre-certification element to it. So there was, I'm thinking about how that might impact the estimate or the report, because of course in those situations there was a sort of maybe it's being used, maybe it isn't kind of element. So I'm not sure that question is directed to you, Dr. Warner, or to the proponents, but have you considered how that would work?
Representative Reed, Mr. Chair, yes, I do remember the credit that begins with a B.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the certification process gives us some additional information. I mean, it gives us a lot more detailed information than we have from a lot of credits that are just through just submitted on the return, and then we get some auditing of them. So I think in that sense it helps. But you're right, one of the difficult things there was to try to determine that timing, and especially to look at in terms of the estimates we had. And we did find, and I think this is a reason for allowing for data lags, and we did find it took 2 to 3 years to really get a sense of what actually happened in that year. And frankly, one of the real problems we had with the original estimate in 2007 was we didn't know where we were at in 2007. We knew where we were at in 2005, but we didn't realize we'd had a big jump really leading up to the expansion of the size of that credit, and so it fueled an increase that was already taking place that we were unaware of at the time.
So, Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up. It sounds like you're comfortable with that can work in the way that it's written?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I am concerned in particular, and this issue just came to me yesterday. I brought it up with one of the proponents. I have been close at hand during the creation of some revenue impact statements, and I know a lot of them are based on information that are estimates. What percentage of bills that we pass relating to tax credits would fall out of the 10% range? Because in my estimation, it might be 100% of the bills we pass may come in greater than the 10%, or very a large proportion could.
Representative Davis, I think that's true. If you look at a lot of the smaller size credits, for example, we have a number of credits that would be less than 100,000. That, you know, maybe we've missed by 20%, which is a small dollar amount. So I think obviously what we would focus on in terms of reporting on this would be those where the revenue difference becomes significant, not the percentage as much as the revenue magnitude. So the 10% of $100 million credits is a lot different than 10% of a million. So we would make sure that we focused our analysis on those where the dollars are.
If I could follow up, I appreciate that, but I don't know if it really addresses the potential problem with the 10% being, in my mind, too small. Mm-hmm. Because if it's a $100 million credit, it's a pretty big credit going to be utilized by an even greater number of taxpayers, which could add even more complexity in my mind, making it less likely to be accurate on the RIS, the revenue impact statement.
May I jump
in? Yeah, please. Yeah.
So I think that's a good point. I think a saving grace of the language as currently structured, and I, you know, wouldn't be opposed to interlineation to change the number if you felt strongly about it, but the point is that it would flag, it wouldn't require a conversation about sunset of, it certainly wouldn't require the automatic sunset of, it would just flag for conversation, hey, there's a lot more uptake of this than people had expected. So the opportunity cost of identifying it need not be extremely high. We're just trying to make sure that we don't have a situation where we radically oversweetened an incentive and then end up giving away a lot more than we intended to yield the benefit that folks were seeking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. This reminds me of the conversations we had when the three-year review was put in place. And it also reminds me of the discussions we've had when we have been trying to appropriately design the tax credit so we didn't have these runaway trains that may have been the case in the past, has been the case in the past. And so as this tax credit discussion has evolved, one would hope that we wouldn't have to utilize the remedy this bill seeks to impose upon ourselves, which is, boy, we sure did a bad job of figuring this thing out, therefore we need to have this bill to come back in and put out the fire. That's what this bill is doing. I'm not saying that we've got it figured out yet when it comes to tax credit design, but my observation is that we're getting better at it because we're doing less, and it seems like, Doctor, we seem to be tightening these things down. You would be in the best position to know, and it's the same question that was just asked: how often is this bill going to be necessary? So it's a long way of getting to that point.
Vice Chair Benz, Mr. Chair, this aspect of it, the 10% flagging, how often would that occur?
Yeah.
I think we, as we would look at these, I would think there would be a fair number where that would be the case. And as Representative Davis pointed out, you know, the 10% is would easily be a margin we would expect from the smaller credits. And so I think we would have to report that, but on the other hand, we would want to report the reasons for it or the magnitude of that in terms of the dollars. We would also be interested in those times when the impact was less, whether it be 10% or 20%, because, you know, you've always had this kind of this dual goal with a credit. If nobody uses it, then what's the point? Mm-hmm. And you run into that same issue when you review the sunset. So if it's way below the estimate, that also raises a flag that it's not, at least there was something we missed in terms of what its assumed usage was. So I would see it as just part of an analysis where if an estimate was significantly off, what are the reasons for it? And that might be part of the analysis of explaining how the credit's being used or how it's being used compared to what was anticipated.
In follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And Chair and I and others worked on these other things in an attempt to figure out how to maintain the our word, if you will, that these tax credits were going to exist, and then come to find out there's more being spent than we thought, so therefore we go in and jerk the rug out from underneath those folks that we're trying to incent to do the very thing they're now doing, but perhaps too much of it. And so this bill reflects this lack of belief that that we'll ever get our act together, and therefore we do need to have this additional control in place in addition to the three-year sunset, and thus further weakening the device, that so-called tax credit, to incent outcomes. Because people will go, why would we ever spend the money on, and we've been going through this in our energy committee in another situation, why would we ever spend the money? We don't believe you that you're actually, and maybe that's the ultimate goal, that we don't want to use tax credits as a funding device. But I would just say that I'm not necessarily opposed to your bill. I'm just commenting upon the unfortunate need for it. How's that?
May I respond? Well, and I appreciate that, and actually in agreement with you that we don't want to cut the legs out from under a useful tax credit unnecessarily. This bill very intentionally does not trigger a sunset review. It very intentionally, and in fact, I think I spoke with Representative Reed, or perhaps even you, in making that decision. Rather, it just triggers flagging, hey, look at this bill or this tax credit is getting uptake at a greater rate than we might have projected, because we don't want to step in right in the middle of one of these processes and take it apart. Also, I would say the utility of the bill, in addition to flagging when uptake is different than what we anticipated, the utility of the bill is also in providing, in the words from the mouth of the proponent, in the first instance, the information that helps us know what it was we were trying to accomplish and how we would measure that Mr. Warner and his colleagues rely on in order to decide whether we should extend. So even if you don't like, you know, reason one, noticing when uptake is too high, hopefully you can take comfort that reason two is a valid reason to move this forward.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. This is for staff. It strikes me, what would the reports required under Section 3 provide that the tax expenditure report does not already provide?
Representative Davis, we would see this as an addition to the report that's done by the tax credit report that comes out, which we have seen as an extension to the tax expenditure report. And of course, what that does is emphasize and highlight those credits that are due for sunset, and tries to do additional analysis on it beyond what is done in the tax expenditure report by the agencies. What I think this does is, one of the aspects of the report that was discussed in 13 was, are there times when we didn't want to limit the report to just the sunsetting credits? And so there's even language in the current statute that says, or additional areas where the revenue committees would want to have additional analysis and information, even whether this credit is scheduled to sunset or not. So we've gotten into the timing issue we've talked about already, about some of these sunsets and whether some of them should have longer sunsets and so forth. But this would be, I would see this as an addition to that. It would be looking at some of these other credits in that report that, according to this criteria, deserve some additional analysis.
Thank you.
Other discussion? Representative Benz?
Are you ready to move it?
Okay, Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3542.
We have a dash one. Yes.
I'm sorry, dash one.
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move dash one amendments to House Bill 3542.
Representative Benz moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3542. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Do you want to move it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benz.
I move House Bill 3542 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 3542 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any other discussion? Representative Benz,
Chairman,
and then Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I'm going to vote for the bill. I will say, though, that it simply illustrates the need to get it right when we do the tax credit to begin with. And when we design it, I will say there's a problem with the bill, but I'm still going to support it, but there's a problem with it in that it shouldn't be focusing upon the revenue impact exceedance. It should be focusing upon whether or not that which is built into the bill or into the tax credit itself is exceeded. Because on occasion, indeed, it may exceed it, but that may be perfectly fine. that may be part of the way the thing was designed. Mm-hmm. And so the but having said that, it I'm happy for the underlying concept, which is to try to get these tax credits so they work better, and that's why I'm going to support the bill. But I would hope if it moves over to the Senate that that part be fixed, and perhaps because I think we're all moving around it, so it does need that repair work. But I'll support it out of committee.
Thank you, Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, colleagues, for I think a good and very useful conversation on this. And I would just like to Representative Vence's point. I think indeed that Section 2 will, which was the originating force behind this bill when we first started talking about it, and that indeed will help us to write better. I think that will indeed help us to write better tax credit policy as well, and I certainly appreciate the input and will continue to utilize it going forward.
Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion, which is to move the bill to the floor with a do pass? I don't see any. For that, the motion carries. Representative Leininger, would you like to carry this bill?
Okay.
Oh, Representative Whitsitt? Do the two of you want to carry it together?
Yeah,
that's right. Why don't the two of you carry it together and you figure out who goes first? All right, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3542 and open a work session on House Bill 3246. I think that's Kyle's property tax issue. And we have an amendment, don't we, that replaces the bill?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair.
So why don't you talk about that?
Okay. So I'm briefly going to touch on the introduced version because it does replace the whole bill, but it contains much of the same information but makes changes to it. But just as a reminder to the committee, House Bill 3246, what it does is it establishes an exemption for qualifying new property or new improvements to property that increase the energy efficiency of the property or reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from the property. So that's the general idea. The changes in the Dash 1 amendment, there's a few of them. The first is that it would apply the exemption only to properties within Multnomah County, or population of 650,000 or more, but that is Multnomah County this time. Second change would be require the property must be, or the property that the new improvements to property that's being affixed to it, so the energy efficient property that's being added, would have to be added to property built prior to 2008. So it's more retrofitting or updating existing property rather than property built after 2008. There is language that would include a requirement for an application for the first year of the exemption. So just as a reminder, this exemption, it's for the first year and then the subsequent 9 years. So by requiring an application the application must be filed prior to the construction or installation of the property, it would avoid any retroactivity of the exemption. And then the last change in the Dash 1 amendments is including sunset language for new applications beginning July 1st, 2022. So existing ones could continue to receive their full 10-year exemption, but new property would not begin to receive the exemption after that sunset date. And then we do have the fiscal and revenue impact, and I can speak to those
please,
if you like at this point. So the fiscal, we have that up in OLIS. It is minimal. And then we have the revenue impact, and this is for the Dash 1, including the Dash 1 amendments. And the revenue impact, so just as a brief reminder to the committee, this really is about new construction of property. And there's two ways that, or when property comes on the roll, there's minor construction and then there's an exception event. And if it's minor construction, you can think of that as just general updates to a piece of property. For energy efficiency, this might be including things of energy efficient light bulbs and smaller things that are under $10,000 in any 1 year or $25,000 over 5 years. It doesn't get picked up on the roll, so that property doesn't get added to the roll, so there's no real property tax increase. Now, for property that does qualify as an exception event, that's new property coming on. That would come on at the real market value of that property multiplied by the change property ratio for that property class, and that's to put it on an assessed value at the average of what that property, existing property, is like for all the other properties on the roll. So if it's new commercial property coming on, it comes on at the commercial CPR, the assessed value. So the revenue impact is primarily what's going to be picked up in the estimate is additions of energy efficient property for commercial property and in some extent multifamily. But in a lot of cases, the residential property energy efficiencies are going to be small enough where they wouldn't be picked up regardless of whether the bill's here or not, because they fall under that $10,000 improvement value. And then also for the revenue impact, you can see it starts in fiscal year 16-17. It is a 10-year exemption. So in year one, you see that initial about $200,000 loss. In year two, you'd have the property that was the new energy efficient property that came on in 16-17 plus then the 17-18. And that's why you see it really the growth in the revenue impact is you do have the previous property that's continuing to receive the exemption as well. And then in keeping with the discussion for the previous bill, I do have the my take on the policy purpose from what I gathered from the public hearing that's included as this does create a new property tax exemption. So that is at the bottom of the revenue impact statement.
Okay, discussion. Representative Davis. And Representative Baker-Peterson.
I'll defer to Peterson first.
Please.
Go ahead.
So I would just say that this is the Dashwood amendments do make a significant change based on the hearing that unfortunately I wasn't able to attend the first public hearing, but just in working with the proponents. In creating the who are working on the Dash One amendments, this came to a place where I think it's the Multnomah County feels very comfortable, you know, leading this program and putting it into practice and seeing what the impact is, you know, during the time that this would be going forward before the sunset. And then there are a couple of things that have been highlighted to change on the Senate side that weren't included in the Dash One amendments. That really have to do mainly with making sure it's very clear that this is property that's like not centrally assessed that would be qualifying for the exemption, and also the fact that since it is going to just be one county that will be doing this instead of having the Department of Revenue set some of these rules up, it makes more sense to just have the county that's the only county that's going to be implementing this actually be the ones that do the rules and make the form for applying to be in this program.
Do you want to bring another amendment here for that?
I think all the proponents that have said they're okay with doing that on the Senate side, know, based on the time.
Ah, okay. So you've checked with the Senate committee and they're, of course, we have a sponsor here, don't we, in the Senate committee. Yes. Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair. Either for the proponents or staff, I do not understand the requirement that the property be built before 2008. What that is about.
We're talking about added conservation measures. If the property's been built since 2008, one presumes there aren't any.
I don't know why there would be that presumption.
Representative Vega-Peterson, you have a better answer to that.
Again, to follow up on the question, why would you assume there's no energy efficiency improvements prior to 2008? The energy codes on residential and manufacturing property haven't changed dramatically since that time.
I believe that was what was put forward in the original bill, so I would have to check on that to find the answer to that question.
Okay.
Oh, we have somebody here who's probably able to answer that, though, if we want to call them up.
Who is that? Please. Always great to have the experts here. If you'll state your name for the record, and then if you can answer that question, that would be very helpful.
Thank you. My name is Dom Kodrum. I'm the Executive Director of the Home Performance Guild of Oregon. Chair, thank you for this opportunity to speak, and Representative Vega-Pearson, thank you for asking the question. And I'm digging through my notes. The 2008 date was a it was supposed to focus on existing buildings. So I think that the idea was when were significant dates in code, both as it relates to residential and as it relates to commercial and multifamily. And I was actually just talking about the fact that 2009 may actually be slightly more ideal, but 2008 still works. Without having the specifics pulled up in front of me, there was a significant residential code change around that date that this would be able to capture, and it was around the date that there was some significant commercial code changes. I mean, really, it's that simple, and I'd be happy to submit more information along that line, but
just to dot the I, I think what you're saying is that the changes that were made in the code required new buildings to be significantly more energy efficient.
Correct.
Thank you.
I don't think significantly.
Representative Johnson?
I might object to the word significantly. There might have been some minor modifications, but I think significant would be a little overboard, I guess, in terms of the criteria, but that's just my opinion.
Representative, what's it?
More a question for what's the anticipated revenue impact for Multnomah County then?
Oh, it's in here, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so that's what we have up on the screen there. It's just limited to Multnomah County.
Okay.
It reduces their income because it exempts this property. Now, in following up on that issue, if I understand it correctly, what we're talking about is that the assessor is going to be checking to see if a property value has increased as a result of construction. If the construction, in Multnomah County at least, is related to increased energy efficiency or reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, then based on the application of the property owner, that could be property tax exempt for 10 years. If it's something else, some other construction that's not related to those two things, it won't do that. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It is limited, and the bill does have some limitation. Not just it reduces it, but it also has to qualify for other tax incentives or meet.
It must qualify for other tax incentives.
Yeah, or improvements that improve the home energy score or energy conservation measures for commercial buildings.
So those are the sideboards.
There is some qualification criteria in there. And then we did have the Multnomah County assessor was here during the public hearing and kind of explained the amount or the revenue loss is the increase in the property's value that's resulting from these things. And the idea is to remove that from the roll. And to paraphrase kind of the discussion, I believe that the assessor was talking about is, it depends upon the construction value, and then they would take some percentage of that because if you spend X amount of dollars, it's not going to be that increase in value necessarily. So it would be reduced by some amount that they would then use.
Okay, so let me give you an example and see if I've got this right. If I understand it correctly, if I had a house in Multnomah County, and an old house, and I replaced all the window sashes with double pane, and I insulated the place, and it led it to a better score on this scale that we're talking about, the response of the assessor would be to come in and say, well, these changes, I spent $30,000 on these changes. The changes, according to the assessor, are worth a $10,000 improvement in the property value. Assuming that I've jumped through all the hoops, what I would get from it would be a $10,000, would be that he would not add the $10,000 to the value of the house for 10 years. That would be the effect of it, wouldn't it? But even though I spent $30,000 on the project,
it would, Mr. Chair, with the exception being that you have to have it has to create an exception event to begin with. So in your example of $10,000, that could be considered minor construction because
I spent $30,000 on it.
But it's the increase in the real market value that determines whether it comes on the roll. Okay. So if it's $10,001, yes.
Change my example to $10,001, then my example's right,
yes.
Is it?
That is
okay.
Correct.
All right. So. It's not really connected with how much money I spent. It's connected with the increased value of the real property, if any.
Yes.
Or if $10,000 plus one or more. Okay. Please, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand. So it requires an application for the first year of exemption to be made prior to construction or installation. So who will make that determination? Where do you go to get the application or to apply for this? I'm on the wrong page. I don't have the dash ones. I'm sorry. I was looking at the old one. Sorry.
And Representative Vega Peterson's already indicated that some of these things may change in the Senate.
Okay.
To make it more obvious.
Yes. And so, the intent is because it is with Multnomah County to have them work with Multnomah County, who is one of the proponents for working on this form of the bill that we have before us, to have them be the clearinghouse for that.
Yes, Representative Woods, it does have, if you're on page 2 of the dash ones, I guess line 7 and 8 talks about the Department of Revenue adopting rules related to the application and the timing of it to specify
still there. Okay.
When it would be submitted.
Okay.
Yes, please, Representative Leininger.
So, so I think this is an appealing bill, and it kind of implicates the questions that we are struggling with in general about diversion of property tax dollars, but on a small scale. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, what to do with that. But what I am curious about is the impact on local education districts is noted. How about the impact on other special districts? Because there are surely a lot of additional special taxing districts that would be affected in Multnomah County? Or am I mistaken?
Yes, Representative. The special districts are included in the local government category.
Okay.
I believe they're about, well, I can't remember specifically from Multnomah County. They're generally around 15-20%, so they'd be even 7% probably of that local government figure up there.
And may I ask a follow-up? And so is there opposition, or are they all on board? Are all the local governments and special districts on board with the proposed bill?
Not a question I can answer.
Oh, what was the question? Sorry.
The question was, are all the local governments and special districts on board, or are they, or is there opposition?
So there's not opposition, but there's just the opportunity for people want to have the opportunity to, I think, opt out of this if they want to, and that's something that we would like to do on the, you know, as a further change to this bill too. Like, for instance, the city of Gresham is
right. I was
yes. So they would like to make sure that they have the opportunity to opt out of this. Which, again, I think the city of Portland and Multnomah County are fine with moving forward with that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Davis.
After the questions, could we have a recess?
I'm inclined, given the hour, to hold this bill over till tomorrow,
I think that's good.
If that works for people. And I think that makes more sense. It's potentially possible that the bill has a constitutional problem that we'll want to discuss between now and tomorrow. And in any event, I think given the hour, and that this is the normal time for adjournment, and that it looks like this is the last item on our agenda today, I think that's what I'd prefer to do. Is there any problem with doing that? I don't see any. So with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3246, and I will note that we'll post it for tomorrow, and we'll continue the conversation then. Okay? With that, we'll close the work session. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Paul wants to... I have a public hearing. Thank you. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2106. I apologize for having missed that. Paul, are you on that one?
No.
Yeah. Having skipped it, I didn't go back to it.
Mr. Chair, I'll have to check the bill assignment process. It seems like I've been up here quite a bit.
You have been, yes.
Modify the process. House Bill 2106 comes to you. It's a committee bill, but we have seen this concept in previous sessions, and what it does is it requires that proportional reduction in specified tax expenditures, which the references are contained in the bill, when the governor, who acts through DAS, reduces allotments to state agencies. As you recall, when we get into situations where our revenue is declining during a biennium, when the legislature isn't in session, the governor has the option of reducing expenditures, general fund expenditures across the board to match what the current forecast is. So cannot reduce them below what the forecast is, but to balance the budget through a proportional reduction. Cannot make target particular agencies or particular activities, has to be across the board. So what this bill does is, when that situation occurs, requires that these tax expenditures that are listed have a reduction in the magnitude of the tax expenditures, which of course would raise revenue by a similar amount as the reduction in spending through the allotments. We do have one particular amendment. Normally we wouldn't look at an amendment in public hearing, but this is one that we wanted to call your attention based on discussions with the Treasury, who pointed this out to us, that the reference to 286A.140, which is not the exact right reference, but it does refer to municipal bond interest and allowing those to be deductible. That would be a major concern for our debt service section in Treasury. Lord Lockwood McCall is here. If you have any questions about that, they brought that to our attention and brought it to the attention of the chair. Just want to make sure, and our recommendation is, you proceed further into work session with this measure, that make sure that that amendment is included to avoid some potential or major problems in the bond markets.
Thank you. I would simply note that this issue came up at the very beginning of the session when the bill was introduced, and one of the commitments that I made at that time was that we would not work this bill without passing the dash one or something equivalent to it to make sure that the bill did not affect our bond situation. Of course, the issue is we've got a contract with the bondholders to pay the bonds, and the bill purports to subject the bond payment to allotment process, which, of course, would destroy our credit rating, so we're clearly not going to do that. So let's hear from Laurie Wimmer, Max Swanson, and I'm going to skip Laura Lockwood McCall because I think I've covered your issue, and Steve Robinson. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. We have requested this concept for a number of years now. Having worked in public affairs for 25 years, I've watched as the state has ridden the highs and lows of our volatile tax and economic system, and noticed that in times of severe and unpredicted recession, services are always on the chopping block, but tax breaks never are. You might say that tax breaks are recession-proof. So over the years, as healthcare, education, public safety have taken haircuts during those revenue drops, those who claim tax expenditures continue to receive the full benefit. So our thought was that if we figured out a way to broaden the base of those who put skin in the game when those rare moments exist, that you have allotment cuts required. And, of course, those will be rarer now that we're in annual sessions rather than biennial. That it would be great to have a way for the governor to make allotment cuts across both sides of the ledger. We have been working with the Department of Revenue on this and have more work to do. You'll see a dash two very shortly. And we've worked with the Treasurer's Office to make sure that we can make this mechanically work. Let me give you an example of how it might work. Let's say that we have one of those unpredicted shortfalls. Let's say the August revenue forecast isn't as optimistic as the May one was just last week, and we find out that we are in a crash and burn situation. Maybe we had a big 9.0, the big one, the earthquake. And so the governor has to make the allotment cuts. Well, if I were to take my $50 political tax credit normally for the 2015 tax year, instead of the 2% allotment cut that was the most recent allotment cut going to programs, maybe they would only take a 1% and the tax breaks would take a 1%. Well, 1% of my $50 is 50 cents, so I would get a $49.50 tax credit, not a $50. In this way, our idea was that you wouldn't eliminate or suspend anybody's tax expenditure. You would simply ask that in those rare moments, both sides of the ledger, for fairness sake, put some skin in the game so that we can balance our budget in those times of shortfall. Some 84 different state tax expenditure programs are listed in 2106. As I said, we have some work to do on that. The Department of Revenue has suggested a couple revisions to that and some questions around carry forwards and so on that we need to resolve. And there are also some that are not there. You won't see medical subtractions for the elderly or Social Security benefits or the earned income tax credit or military active duty pay. You won't see those touched. We do feel that this is a fair, simple to administer, with timing considered carefully, proposal. And we hope that once we have the final amendments before you that you will accept this as a way to make sure that in those times of emergency that we are able to balance our books in a fair way.
Chair, question? Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Matt Swanson. I am with the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. We are happy to be here today supporting House Bill 2106. I think that for brevity's sake, I'm not going to repeat a lot of what I heard. I just think what we hope this bill accomplishes is really setting services on par with other tax expenditures. I think that in the way that allotment cuts have come down, they're oftentimes we hold certain services, especially those that go to low income and vulnerable populations, at a lower priority than some of the tax breaks and tax expenditures that are on the books. And I think that that's a fundamentally flawed approach, especially when we are in tough times. I think, you know, we've seen that the multiplier of certain programs like food stamps can go much further and have a bigger impact on the economy. And those are the sort of things that we need to help people versus, say, perhaps some of the other programs. And I think spreading out some of the pain, if you will, is an important tool in the toolbox for the governor to have, especially when times are tough. So knowing that there are some technical amendments forthcoming, I think that we will continue to work with proponents and perfect this bill, but we're strongly supportive at this point and hope that you will move it forward to the floor. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Robinson with Decision Metrics. I'll be very brief. I strongly support the idea of having both tax expenditures and general fund expenditures on the same handled the same way during this extreme event of a allotment cut. I think that's an important principle. From a pragmatic standpoint, and I know the legislature is nothing if not pragmatic. There's a very long list of tax expenditures listed in the bill as currently written, and I would just simply suggest that an 80-20 rule might be appropriate to look at this list and maybe to eliminate those that would either be very difficult to administer, and I'm sure that there are several on this list that would be very difficult to administer, and it would be also very small, and from the pragmatic standpoint, there'd be no practical reason to include them. I don't want to go through the list. I think that's just a question that needs to be addressed. And those that would adversely affect the very people who are going to be most affected by a downturn, the working family child care credit, for example, as Lori mentioned, the EITC is not affected, but there are some that we may find wouldn't be appropriate to affect in this kind of circumstance. So I'm suggesting, yes, by all means, please continue working on this bill. But cutting down the number of tax expenditures affected by 50, 60, 70% might be called for just from a pragmatic standpoint. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Marcia Kelly, Jody Weiser. Anyone else would like to be heard on this bill today?
For the record, Jody Weiser, I think it's been well stated already. I don't need to say more.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Marcia Kelly, this time wearing two hats. First, as one of the temporary co-chairs of the HISCO Tax Revenue Coalition. This goes to the HISCO priorities under tax revenue, fairness, adequacy, stability, and transparency. And so HISCO would support this. For my other hat, the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, I would also like to suggest that for those programs that require certification, say from the Department of Energy or Business Oregon, there could be included in their application process a statement that they understand that in downturn times that their tax credit would be reduced. That's, you know, it just seems like a real simple thing to include in all of those applications if this bill goes forward, and we do hope it goes forward because of the equity issue of downturns requiring more services.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2106. See you all tomorrow. With that, the committee is adjourned.